Jim Everett is a playwright and a poet. His written work includes short stories and plays and political essays. For years, Jim was a fisherman, catching crayfish and scallops and sharks. For a little while, he worked on a Norwegian oil tanker cruising around the world, and there was a stint in the army as well. Jim Everett always knew he was Aboriginal, but it wasn't until he was 16 that he came to understand that his family were Tasmanian Aboriginal people. And for years, Jim was involved in Aboriginal politics and community organisations. Today, Jim mostly lives on Cape Barron Island in Bass Strait, where he writes and enjoys the wild and spectacular landscape. Hello, Jim.
How are you going there, Richard?
I'm well, thank you, sir. Tell me about your mum and dad. Let's start with them. Where did they meet?
They both grew up on Cape Barron Island. Their parents as well grew up on Cape Barron Island, and all their families, extended families. And Dad was courting Mum, I think, from about the age of 15 or 16. Later on, I think when Mum was about 17, her mother and father moved across to Flinders Island, I think more for employment than anything. Dad followed, and eventually they married on at Flinders and lived at a place called Pine Scrub.
How much education did they have?
Dad had some better education than Mum. That's about all I know, but he was better educated. He could read newspapers and everything okay, write fairly well. Mum had very limited formal education. She had about 3 years. They would have been sort of basic education, but she was not very literate. As I grew up, I found that she couldn't read newspapers very well, struggled, it was some years later before she was able to overcome that.
Once World War II ended in 1946, the whole family moved to Victoria, and I think you were about 4 years old at the time. Tell me about the place the family moved to in Victoria, Jim.
Yeah, well, Dad went over first and found woodcutting work for pulp wood in southeast Gippsland with a contractor at Morwell. So we moved over there and we stayed with this fellow and his family for a while Dad built a one-room shack on the banks of a little creek called Sassafras Creek between Morwell and a place called Ballara.
Tell me about the fishing there on Sassafras Creek. What memories you have of that?
I always saw that as our supermarket, I can tell you. It was marvellous. We had plenty of freshwater crayfish, there was plenty of trout, plenty of blackfish and plenty of eels. So we basically lived out of that creek. Besides, Dad would go out and get kangaroo and wallaby and sometimes some bird life. And we always was able to get wild bee honey. And one of the other things that was available there was that there was plenty of orchards with the farmers there, and they didn't mind us going and helping ourselves to the pears and the apples.
Was it idyllic? You're painting a really idyllic picture here, Jim.
It was. Some of my best memories of my young life. There was myself, my sister, she was about a year and 5 months younger than me, and my brother, who was 6 years older than me, because my mother had lost a boy between my brother and I. So it was really good. Had a good family life, and our extended family had moved across from Tasmania with us, mainly to get away from the low self-esteem of being Aboriginal in Tasmania, and get away from the racism in Tassie at the time. That gave them all a rest away from that, and tried to disappear in the mainland, society.
So you could be more fully human in that.
I think that that's what they thought. Hmm. Unfortunately, my parents and us kids were still seen to be blackfellas, but they just the family never talked about it. So we that's why I didn't really know where the devil are we from? What the devil are we?
So in the 50s, then the family moved to St Kilda.
Yes.
I can't think of a place that would be more different than living by Sassafras Creek.
Absolutely.
What sort of place was St Kilda in the 50s? What do you remember of that?
Yeah, it was really good. We moved there about 1952, 53, and we lived down Ackland Street.
Right, around all the great Jewish cake shops and all
just
that.
A bit up from there, near on the corner of Robe Street and Ackland Street, actually, where we had rooms, they used to call them in them days, your shared kitchen, your shared bathroom. And I started selling newspapers, so I'd be about 11. And so I was selling newspapers around Luna Park and down the bottom end, down that Jewish quarter,
Was it easier being Aboriginal amongst a group of new Australians and migrants than it would have been in the older, whiter British Anglo population at the time?
We certainly didn't feel like we were being, you know, focused on and discriminated at that time. There was a lot of dark-skinned Europeans coming into the country, and people just didn't really worry about it, you know. And we were used to being around Maltese people and Italian people.
There were three kids in your rooms. Were you a noisy bunch?
Yeah, pretty noisy.
What sort of things would make your mum go mad at you?
Well, firstly, my brother, as I say, 6 years older. So, look, you know, by the time I'm 10, he's 16. He started work cutting wood and he became a man, if you like, at the age of 13. He left school and started work, you know. So he was sort of out of the picture a lot. Although he lived there, he was able to sort of go and do what he liked, and it was my sister and I that were always getting into trouble, fighting over whose turn it was to wash up the dishes and whose turn to wipe up. And we were taught to cook and all that at a very young age, so, you know, lots of arguments over whose turn to cook and what we should cook. And
Was there a lot of pressure on you and your sister to be good kids, you know, to not to stick your neck out too much and not to make
from
too much?
From a very early age.
Very early age?
For being in South East Gippsland. For instance, my mother was always insistent that we wore our boots, and we had boots, not shoes, when we was outside, because barefootedness to her drew attention to us as being blackfellas, and she didn't want that to happen. She was trying to be accepted by white society, you know, doing a face up with Pond's cream and everything to whiten the face up. I don't know how she thought that was going to work. It didn't cover the rest. She was very obviously an Aboriginal woman.
That stuff, when that's ingrained into you as a kid, that tends to stay with you. And I notice, you know, you've been very outspoken in your adult life. Have you always felt like you've had to work against the grain of that lesson of, you know, don't, you know, keep a low profile?
No, I think I just sort of slowly evolved into it. And it was never really consciousness of what I was doing. It was just, I felt that later in life, I felt that when I became part of the political movement, that I had to take a role, because I had a confidence in that. I, you know, you don't think about these things when you're young, but later I look back and think, yeah, I had a confidence that I should be there. Let's make change.
What was your first job at the age of 14, Jim?
I was a telegram boy at the St Kilda Post Office.
Oh, you have to go out and actually hand-deliver telegrams?
Yep.
How were you treated there in that job?
I left school at 14. I left primary school at 14. Back in those days, they had a post-primary grade 7, so I did the post-primary grade 7. It was specially designed for kids who were going to turn 14 after primary school that had been completed. And once you got to 14, you could leave school and go to work. So I did that, and I got the job as a telegram boy, and then I enrolled in the South Melbourne Tech College to do night school. And the postmaster gave me permission to knock off early on the Thursday evenings that I was to go to night school. The foreman of the telegram boys was a much older fellow, an Englishman, who took a dislike to me, and he made it really difficult. He'd give me half a dozen telegrams about, you know, half an hour before I'm supposed to knock off and head off on my bike to South Melbourne.
Why, he knew you had to go to night school, did he?
Yeah.
He put all that in your way, did he?
The postmaster came down and told him, you know, Jim's going to be knocking off on Thursdays at 4 o'clock, you know, to go to night school, and that's okay. But he always made it difficult by giving me the extra work that I couldn't possibly finish it and then get to night school.
Why would he? That's just naked racism, do you think? Or what
was it? Yeah, it was, I think. Yeah. At the time, I didn't sort of recognise it. I just thought, well, he just doesn't like me. When you're a teenager sort of thing, you tend to think it's what kind of kid you are rather than what your colour is.
Yeah, you blame yourself, you know? I suppose. That must be something I've done. Yeah.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. I wrote a resignation saying, you know, I'm leaving because, he's making me work too late on Thursdays and I can't get there. And the next thing I know, I've got the General Post Office police from upstairs. They've got their own sort of fraud squad or something, and they're down and take me upstairs and say, son, you can't do this. You'll be in a lot of trouble. We'll help you write a resignation that won't get you into trouble. Just you're leaving to go to another job. You'll be right. So I did that, and then years later I thought to myself, they came down and saved that fella.
So you left. You exonerated this thorough bastard.
Yeah.
Where did you go from there, work-wise?
I had a couple of jobs. I was delivering groceries on a push bike for a bit and didn't like that, so I wagged it until my mum found out and made me take up an apprenticeship as an upholsterer in a factory. And I hated factory work, so I didn't last long there. 6 months, I did pretty good, 6 months. And she finally got me a job with her cooking Chico rolls at Wing Young's, a Chinese Chico roll factory at the Queen Victoria market.
See, with Chico rolls, I don't know if we ever give a lot of thought to how a Chico roll is made. I don't know if we once, like, you know, sausages and democracy, you know, how they or Chico rolls want to be made. What was life like for you in the Chico roll factory,
Jim? It was really good. Yeah. And I can tell you that, like, I see them mix the ingredients up for Chico rolls, and I had no fears of eating them.
Oh, that's good.
No,
that's good to know.
Beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really a kind of a great big spring roll, I suppose, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, you see, they don't even put chicken into things unless you buy a chicken Chico roll. These were ground beef Chico rolls.
And how were you treated in that workplace? How did you get
really,
on there?
Really, really good. The Chinese used to have their own cook-ups. This wasn't all the time. But when they did, I was the only non-Chinese that was invited to sit with them to have this meal that they have this special cook-up. So I felt pretty special, actually. They really looked after me. I don't know why the Chinese liked me, but they did. Yeah.
Jim, one of your relatives, amazingly, was the infamous Ronald Ryan, the last man to be hanged in Australia. How were you connected, family-wise, to Ronald Ryan?
Yeah, Ronald Ryan was the half-brother to a fellow by the name of George Thompson, who married my mum's sister, my auntie Sylve. And we sort of grew up with Ronald Ryan. And Ron was cutting bush with Dad for a while up there outside of Mowi. We'd moved from Morwell to Mowi before we went into St Kilda, so we was cutting bush there. I used to spend a lot of time in the bush with Dad and with Ron. And then we, when we moved into the city, Ron and his wife Dorothy and the two girls, they moved in and... wherever we moved, the extended family seemed to follow us. And we worked on a number of jobs together. I did some part-time work much later before Ron got into trouble with the law and ended up in Pentridge, working on jobs like Monash University and stuff like that.
How was he with you? Do you remember him personally when you were a kid?
Very much so, yeah. Oh, he's a wonderful man. He was a quiet fellow. He wasn't a braggart or anything like that. His problem was he was a gambler, and I think that's where his problems really lie. He used to train me for bike riding, so he'd get me out riding bikes, and then when it came for a competition day at Your Lawn, which is I think it was about 12 miles away, he'd jump on my push bike and ride it to Your Lawn while see me off on the bus. Make sure I was there for the bus, jump on my bike, ride it to Your Lawn for me because you weren't allowed to take it on the bus. And he was there waiting for me. So when I jumped off the bus, I jumped straight on the bike and he'd give me a push. He'd say, they're off, get going. And I'd just go straight through the starter's gate there and they'd wave me through. And I actually got a second, even though I was late when I got there, about the second time I had a ride there, yeah.
It's not universally, but there's a widely held view that he was never guilty of that murder for which he was hanged.
Yeah.
You remember him as this incredibly kindly
uncle, he was.
Ben.
He was a really, really nice man. And, I felt pretty close to him. He was really close with my brother and my father, but he was a bit younger than my dad, and my brother got mixed up in some of his illegal activities, and they were both arrested at the same time. When Ron went into jail, into Pentridge, and he made a deal with the coppers that he would plead guilty if they let my brother go, and they agreed, and they let my brother go. I was there when my brother was arrested. I woke up one morning with a plainclothes detective there with a gun to my head. And I had a mate from the army with me in the other single bunk in the same room. And so they tried a bit of a trick on us and reached under the bed and pulled their hands out and said, oh, look here, 3 9mm rounds. Have you ever seen anything like this, boys? Yeah, we see them all the time, and their eyes lit up. And they said, where do you see these? We use them in Owen guns in the army, mate. And they give us a dirty look and walked out of the room. And the next thing I see, my brother being marched down the hallway with his handcuffs on.
Do you remember being told that your uncle Ronald Ryan had been hanged?
I was in Melbourne at the time with the family. We were all sitting down listening on the radio, and... Everyone was very quiet. Everyone was very sad that the people had tried to stop that happening, hadn't been able to, and the whole family was very upset, and I was too. And we just sat there, and basically there was nobody saying anything. Mm.
When you were about 16, like I said right at the start, there was something that happened to change the way you understood your family heritage. Tell me what happened there, Jim.
Well, Ronald Ryan and Dad had bought a 40-foot diagonal planked lifeboat off a big liner, and they put a deck on it and stuck an old junker's motor in it, diesel motor, and a mast that was about probably 12 feet high and a tiller that was about 8 foot long. And away we went, long line sharking that Dad had helped set up. Anyway, I talked my way into that first trip. Well, when we got round to San Remo and we saw real fishing boats, Ron sort of decided it was time for him to go back to the city, so at least us and Dad could see that his idea of a fishing boat wasn't going to be any good compared to the real boats that were set up properly. So he and I got a job on fishing boats and on shark boats. And we finished up fishing around Flinders Island and went into Flinders Island, Port Lady Barron. And the first person I ran into was one of my cousins, Pat Green, or Pat Everett then, and Patsy Cameron. And they said, well, look, Jim, you should come with us and have a look and meet the rest of your mob. And they took me down to Yellow Beach, which is just on the edge of the township of Lady Barron.
Did you know you had a mob there at that time?
No, but it's mutton bird time, see. It's just getting the start of the mutton bird season. And they're all camped down in under the tea tree, prepared for when the boats take them out to the islands. And as soon as I walked in under the canopy, and it was night time, and all the fires going, and as soon as I seen them all, I thought, oh, I knew he was Tasmanian Aboriginal. I've always thought that we was, because I'd grown up in the schools like everyone else being told there's no more Tasmanian Aboriginals, Truggan and he's the last.
I was told that too. Yeah. I was told that as well, but that wasn't true.
No.
And your family were Tasmanian Aboriginal.
Yeah.
And once you knew that, what did you make of that?
Well, firstly, I started to understand why my parents and grandparents and uncles and aunties would never speak about it. They'd been conditioned to be ashamed of being Aboriginal, so they just would not talk about it. And they'd call themselves blackfellas, and they'd even have arguments about the sort of classifications that were placed on them by white society as quarter caste, half caste, and so forth. And they'd be arguing about, oh, no, so-and-so was quarter caste. No, no, he wasn't, he was half caste, and so on. So, and then they would only do that behind closed doors, and us kids were earwigging, and that's how I only heard that. So I sort of understood my parents, and I understood why Mum was making us put our boots on and everything. And from that time on, I have always pursued the understanding of, well, what is it that is being Aboriginal? What does that mean to me? And I pursued that all of my life.
I have to ask you, because I almost wanted to jump on what you said. Yeah, we went out sharking. Sharking? You went out, what, shark fishing?
Yes.
In Bass Strait?
Bass Strait mainly, yeah, but around King Island, west coast of a Tassie in parts.
That sounds like a dangerous profession to me, Jim. What's involved in shark fishing from a small boat?
Dangerous. It's damned hard work.
Right. What's involved in that? We're talking about the 1950s here, 60s, aren't we?
Yeah, 1958, right. 59.
What did shark fishing in 1958, 59 mean?
We'd shoot about 10 miles of long line with 2,400 hooks in 7 sets. So you had the shark hook with a wire trace and then a cord snood and then tied onto a clip that just clipped onto the line. So as the line went out, one of us would be passing the clips to the person that was clipping them on, and they clipped them on and let them drop out the back. And that's how we did it. When they came up, you'd be clipping them off until you got to, when you got fish, well, you'd gaff them as well and bring them aboard.
So you're hauling up sharks onto the deck, one at a time from these long lines. Yeah. And are they still alive, or do you have to...
Oh, sure. Yeah. My job was to cut their heads off, actually. I remember once we had a shot there. It was the best day's fishing I'd seen. Shot 2,400 hooks. We pulled up 1,100 shark. So I cut 1,100 shark heads off.
1,100 shark heads in a day?
Yep. Not possible now. The shark nets have really killed the industry, but back then there was plenty of shark, and we just happened to hit a school, quite small shark, just oversized, 30 inches or more, and great for the market. The market loved the smaller sharks than the bigger sharks, and 1,100 sharks.
So you had a big knife or something, and would stand there on the deck as they came on board?
I actually stood in a well that was sort of a bit higher than the deck. I'd stand there, it'd be about a metre deep, and I'd stand on duck boards, because under that there was a well, so you'd throw them into the well and let them bleed while you know, and then the man who, or two men maybe sometimes, who would be gutting the shark and cleaning them, would gaff them out and do them as they went, but I'd be cutting their heads off and throw them in there, and the shark heads would be thrown over to a corner, and we'd box them later and give them to the crayfishermen.
What's that like, that kind of work? I've never done anything like that in my entire life. I can't imagine what that work's like.
Yeah, the thing about fishing is that, especially back, doing long lining and cutting shark heads and all that sort of thing, you're used to killing things. That's the name of the game. And so I grew up being quite used to killing shark and other fish, to the point that you just see it as your job.
Tell me how the skipper on this boat would sometimes get cheap labour for his sharking boat.
Yeah, his name was Laurie. I won't give his last name, but Laurie. He had a bad problem. He used to drink too much, and he was a bad gambler. His fishing reputation was not real good around the fishing circle, so he couldn't just easily get a crew. So anyway, we used to tie up at Spencer Street Bridge in Melbourne, and so he'd go ashore. By this time, we worked in a second boat. I started off in a smaller boat with him. Now I'm on a big 68-foot ex-trawler boat. So he'd go up to the pub, and I'd be on board. He said, oh, well, you know, I'd be baiting up and getting all the bait ready and everything. I'd go to bed, and then about 9 o'clock that night, he'd roll on board with two winos, generally, as we called them, and they'd be fellas that loved their wine, and they'd sit down in the forecastle. My bunk was there too. So,
how drunk were these men?
Oh, pretty drunk.
Blind drunk,
including
right,
himself.
Right, all of them, right.
Yep. And as soon as they flaked it, as soon as they went to sleep, he'd immediately get up and say, "Right, Jim, now we'll throw the lines off. We're going to sea." Okay.
what would happen the next day when these poor winos woke up, Jim?
Yep, he'd line them up for the thing and say, "Hey, right, you fellas, you're out of here with us. We're sharking, so you're gonna." So you're gonna work, or otherwise you won't get any wine tonight. And and that was the deal. And you'll get paid when we get back.
They were press ganged. This is the old press ganging.
They were press ganged. They were shanghaied.
Shanghaied. I think that's the worst hangover nightmare, isn't it? Waking up with a hangover the next day and being told you're forced to go into shark fishing.
You know, these fellas probably didn't have much life ashore. Yes. And I can say too that they had a go.
What? Yeah, they did. They made all right. They did all right as crew, did they?
I had to do the experience work because I was experienced. But the kinds of things that they could do, these fellas had a go, and I never saw one of them shirk it. They'd have a real go, you know, and they had a bit of wine each night, but not enough to sort of make it so that they couldn't work next day.
Right, so they dried out a little bit then.
Did some
solid work. Yeah. I think they got paid at the end, I assume, too.
One might think that he was actually running a rehabilitation program.
Look, it's just, well, maybe put this idea out for community services. Don't say no straight away.
That's right.
But
yeah.
Jim, tell me why you decided then to join the army after that.
Well, I didn't actually join the army straight away. Firstly, I changed boats to a cray boat, and I worked with that cray fisherman for 3 years. I think it was three, might have been 2.5 years, something like that. But I worked with old George Swaller for 2.5 years, I reckon. He sacked me because I was just became an naughty boy. I bought a car at age 17, not old enough to hold a licence, and he said, "Don't go driving the car unless I'm with you." And I actually used to pinch it out of the garage and drive it, so in the finish he got sick of me and sacked me. So I went steeplejacking. So I was painting smokestacks around Melbourne and up in the country, your lawn. The biggest stack I painted was 348 feet high. It took 3 months because it was about 48 feet girth. And anyway, I had a mate that was in the CMF, the Weekend Warriors Army sort of stuff, and I talked to him about it a bit. I'm going to go and join the Army, and so I did.
Why?
Well, it was a uniform, and I was interested in girls, and uniforms usually find girls, and I thought, well, why not? Everything's found, they give you a uniform, they pay you, and you travel.
It's an extreme way to go about attracting girls, I think, isn't it, Jim?
Well, I'd never been out of Victoria, right? And I knew that if I joined the army, they'd send me up to Kapooka, and then I could be stationed anywhere in Australia.
So you didn't mind army life, did you? But if that's the case, why did you start going AWOL?
Yeah, I didn't mind it. I was in signals to start with, but they reneged on a radio operator's course, so I transferred to engineers, and I was in small ship squadron, on tank carrier barges. It was during that time my mother was diagnosed with angina, and they were given 3 years to live. They didn't have any, the pharmaceutical technology to actually deal with it. So I started to apply for compassionate leave, and I was refused, and I started to go AWOL.
Well, going to see your mum, you mean?
I didn't even get there, because they live on Flinders Island, and I'd either run out of money and give myself up in Melbourne, or I'd get caught at the airport or something, you know. Then I decided, well, look, I've had enough of this. So I put in an application for discharge on compassionate grounds, and, of course, that was refused. So I went AWOL every month, and finally I thought to myself, no, this is no good. I've got to do it a bit better than this. So finally I took up an alias name of one of my old schoolmates, actually, and I went up into Queensland, and I worked on the railways as a fettler for a while. Then I went down to Melbourne and worked in a factory that made coffee decanters, those beautiful silver coffee decanters, and I was taught by the old fellow there, who was the drop hammer operator that actually made the raw article before it was silvered. And finally got a ticket under my alias name and flew back to Flinders. 5 months later, the federal policeman came over and said, right, I'm here to take you down to Anglesey, you're being discharged. I said, good.
Well, they found you in the end.
They knew who I was, I reckon, by the time, not long after I got there.
They really should have given you compassionate leave, though, if your mum was dying.
They knew they'd done the wrong thing. And when I got my discharge, although they put nothing on my discharge, the thing is, they paid me every penny they owed me, and they knew that they had done the wrong thing and at least resolved the issue of how much I should be paid. They gave me everything I was due.
You had a whole lot of different jobs. You jumped onto a Norwegian tanker at one point.
That's right, not long after leaving the army, actually.
Where did that take you?
It's a funny story about how I actually got that. I was working at a shealite mine on King Island, and I had a falling out with a girlfriend there. I thought, well, this is no good. So I went to the pub and got drunk, actually, and jumped on an aeroplane and flew to Melbourne. By the time I got to Melbourne, I didn't know what I was doing. And I seen a ticket office that said New Zealand. I thought, yeah, I'll go to New Zealand. So I went and bought a ticket in New Zealand and got off in Auckland. And a mate of mine had just signed off this tanker, and I said, you reckon you can get me on that tanker? Oh, yeah. So anyway, I got the job on the oil tanker, the Magnolia, 20,000-tonne oil tanker, working under contract to the New Zealand government, shipping fuel around the coast of New Zealand from Whangarei.
Where did it take you?
Well, finally, it took me up to the Persian Gulf and into Iran, to a place called Abadan. And I spent 12 hours ashore there. You know, much time ashore off oil tankers. And then down to Saudi Arabia to a place called Ras Tanura. And when it came back down south, the only port in Australia it was calling into was Darwin. I thought, I've never seen Northern Australia, so I'm signing off there. And I'd had enough of the ship. I only went on it to get some adventure. Well, I had that. Now I said, well, I want to have an adventure on the northern part of Australia.
Were you any better with the girls by then?
No, I don't think I was, actually.
You had your own cray boat in the 1970s,
yes.
Jim. Which part of the world were you talking about?
Yeah, Flinders Island. I bought a 45-foot steel cray boat called the Christine Carroll, and I ran that for 8 years.
You harvested scallops as well, didn't you? How did you do that?
Yeah, scallops became pretty popular amongst the boats, and we were all putting on scallop gear, quite heavy gear, heavy dredges called Spudniks. So I did the same and was fishing around the islands and between the islands and the mainland of Tasmania, scalloping, and it was a pretty hard game. Not a lot of money to be made in it, but it was better than craying at the time, you know, that time of year.
Tell me about your last trip.
The last trip, there was about 40 boats in a drag, and I'm in the drag, and it's just off the west side of Flinders Island. my clutch failed, and so the wire that you tow the dredge with pulled right off the drum, and I've lost her. So I quickly steamed back along it to an area about, I configured about halfway along the wire, and dropped the marker with a flag on it and went back to port. About 2 days later, when everyone had finished there, I went back out, dropped the grapple and picked up my wire and reconnected my dredge. So I thought, oh, well, I might as well have a drag over the drag with these fellas at Boone, see if they left anything. And all I dragged up was mangled fish and mangled marine plant life. Just like a blender had been down there and blended it up into a big mess, really. And I thought to myself, I never, ever became a fisherman to do this. I'm getting out. So I went straight back to port and took my scallop gear off the boat, and I put my boat in the market, and I sold it within 6 months.
Well, you just really became aware that this was no good. It was just tearing
you
up the hull.
You were over-exploiting, right, and doing some bad things to the sea. And I thought, no, this is not where I'm a fisherman, and I got out.
So where did you go from there?
I was a rigger for a while. I'd done rigging on and off before this, but I became a construction rigger, demolition rigger. I did a number of things. And one day I just read there was an advertisement for an Aboriginal Legal Aid field officer with the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre in Launceston. So I applied for that, got that, and I was on a whole new learning curve.
What kind of work was that?
Mainly organising for people who were in trouble with the law to have legal representation in court, people that sort of put their hands up and say, yes, we'll handle Aboriginal cases.
Well, it's important and difficult work, but yeah, it's a million miles different from being your own man out in the on the water, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
How did you like it, though?
I did, for two reasons. One, it was our community really needed that legal representation in court because they were getting bad deals otherwise. And the other thing is I was getting to know my community much better because I had to travel around in the Aboriginal community in the Launceston area in particular, and so it reconnected me with relatives that I hadn't previously known about. It was after I'd finished as a legal aid officer, only there in that job for about 5 months, 1979. The first Aboriginal specified position in the state government was opened up, State Liaison Officer, Aboriginal Affairs. So I got that. That's when I became what you might call a spy within the midst, a mole within the government itself.
How was that working? How were you working in both roles?
Well, firstly, they wanted me to sort of head up a welfare thing, and I said, no, this is no good for me, a welfare, and the director at the time agreed with me, so I changed it into being an advisor to the government on Aboriginal affairs at a low level. I worked specifically to the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre because it was the one that was carrying the politics, and so I helped organise protests, I got information out to them about kinds of things that were happening that they might want to take up political action on. Mansell trained us to deal with media, for instance, so that you weren't sidetracked, you know. You've got an issue, and they ask you a question that tries to take you away from that onto something that they can sensationalise. He trained us to stick with the issue, don't move away from it. And in that way, the media couldn't use you. And that got me into more public speaking around schools. I did going around schools, talking to kids and stuff like that, and that helped me become a bit more confident as a speaker in a public place.
You and others set up a tent embassy in Hobart. How long did that last for?
Oh, it was probably there for about 3 or 4 days. The first tent we put up was a small tent, but a tent big enough to hold about 10, 15 people. And we're in it there one evening, one afternoon, it was late afternoon, and we've got children, women and children in there, and the next thing you know, the police had jumped on us. Squashed the tent. There was women and kids screaming and frightened, and they were very rough. And anyway, they took that tent. So then we sat under an even smaller tent or around the outside of it. Maybe one could sort of fit in the tent. So they come and took that away from us. So then we got a beach umbrella. We sat under the beach umbrella, and they came and took the beach umbrella away from us. By this time, I think we'd made a public political protest quite wide. And
How was the media coverage of that? Was it?
Yeah, pretty good.
Was it sympathetic? Yeah. I mean, by the time when you're sitting under a beach umbrella,
you never know about whether it was sympathetic. The thing is that they certainly put it out there, and it was quite obvious that, you know, we were being treated pretty harshly. And then the police inspector came down and said, right, you can go and get your tents back from up the police station there. For some reason or other, they weren't saying we couldn't go back there and continue the protest, which we did, but they let us have our tents back.
Jim, land rights came to Tasmania later than in the rest of Australia. Why do you think that is?
We were in a struggle from before I actually got involved with politics, I'd say. And for about 25 years, the major campaign was to break this binary sort of thing that we were extinct people, and to have the Tasmanian government and the Tasmanian community at large to accept us as a living Aboriginal community with rights inherent.
If it's commonly acknowledged that Aboriginal people in Tasmania are extinct, that mean you're always being called imposters? Or
It's been known. I think we've gone past that now, of course. I think we actually achieved our objective when the first government that set up a bill for land rights was the Michael Field government, the Labor government. He lost office. By this time, I'm managing the Office of Aboriginal Affairs in the Premier's Department. He set that up and I got that job. Then Ray Groom, a Liberal Premier, came in, and instead of dumping the land rights thing, he just whittled it down a little bit in terms of how many parcels of land were going to be in the bill and saw it through. And that was the acknowledgement of our living Aboriginal community and our rights.
You talked about connecting with your mob in Tasmania. Where is the country of your people, Jim?
If you're looking at Tasmania, look down through the middle of Tasmania between Launceston and Hobart. We're about a third of the way down at a place that's known as Mount Ben Lomond. In our language, it's known as Turbunna. I come from one of three clans off the northeast or northern end of Turbunna, Plangamarina. The land that goes between Turbunna and the coast is known as Minamata country. And it's sort of like a collective hunting ground. There's no boundaries of ownership from the clans. So I have to assume, really, but I think that was a collective hunting ground that they all, it's like the commons, if you like. Everybody had a use of it.
How much of the language has been conserved?
Not a great deal. Enough for the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre to redevelop a language called Palawakani, and our kids use that fairly well. I don't know much of it. I still use some of the old recorded languages, and I say languages because a lot of the language that I use may come from a variety of clans.
Do you have any title to your country?
No. We have probably about 18 parcels of land that we have a statutory land council under the Lands Act, the Aboriginal Lands Act, and that statutory land council holds the titles and manages those lands or allocates those lands to organisations like the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre or where I live on the Cape Barron Island Aboriginal Association. We manage our island.
Do you identify as Australian?
No. No. I've been asked this at an Indigenous Knowledges conference once in Italy, and I said to them, I said, no, I'm not Australia's imagined Aborigine or Indigenous, nor am I an Australian citizen. I'm Plangamarina.
That's the name of your clan?
Yeah.
From central Tasmania?
Yeah.
What work are you doing to maintain the culture of your clan in that part of the world?
Well, I think you look more broadly at the Tasmanian Aboriginal community because everybody's doing something who have that interest. Now, not everybody does, of course. Everybody's been partially assimilated to the dominant culture's way of doing things, of course. We all hold jobs, drive motor cars, use computers, very much like everybody else. People at weekends go fishing. They might go hunting for shellfish, like abalone and werriners and the like, and whelks. Many people go mutton birding, and this year I hope to join my son, who will be mutton birding on Big Dog Island. Most important for me, I think, is to I've been working on and been doing something towards bringing back ceremony into our community. I think that's very important for young people to understand what being Aboriginal means, what it means to be connected to your country, how that makes up your identity. And for young fellows in particular, I think that might help them overcome some of the issues. Young men seem to be the ones that find that more difficult because their role is gone as hunters and such. But women have always got their role, always have had their role as, the nurturing of men, children and families, and the women have never lost that.
So is that what you see as a large part of what you want to achieve, is find ways to accord honour to young men? Aboriginal young men,
yes.
Particularly?
Yes.
And what kind of ceremony are we talking about here, taking young men to participate in what kinds of ceremony?
I've been working with an elder man up in New South Wales, an Uncle Max Harrison, He turned 80 this year, and a marvellous old fellow, and a very wise fellow, and I've been learning from him. So I'm taking 10, at least 10 anyway, of young fellows up there to New South this September. We'll go through law ceremony with Max and some young men up there. Then when we come back, we'll get ourselves together, and having that experience and what we know of our own culture and ceremonies.
What can you tell me about that ceremony? Are you able to tell me anything at all about it? And if so, is it in
the law ceremony?
Yeah.
It's really about understanding the rules that apply from what we commonly call the law of the land. So understand how to treat your country, how to have respect, how that respect transfers across families. Young men sometimes love their country more than they love women in their community, and we think that's something that contributes to family and domestic violence. And I think that by bringing ceremony back, the men will have a bit of pride and see that by the way that they love their country is the way that they should love their families.
Are you finding it hard to make young Aboriginal men care about that? Or on the other hand, are you finding there's a real hunger for this?
I think there's a hunger for it. I think that I'm probably a tip of the iceberg and where I can facilitate for some young men. I see them like a succession plan for carrying on ceremony in the future. But, you know, I'm getting older, and I think that these younger men are going to have to carry the candles.
Jim, there's an incident in your life which we've got to talk about, which is your trip to Libya with Michael Mansell. How on earth did that come about?
I was at the time producer of ABC's Blackout, which we now know as Message Stick. And I was there in 87, and I was making a film on the big bicentennial protest in Sydney called One People Sing Freedom. And Mansell went to Libya in 87 and turned the world topsy-turvy in Australia, and you had Bill Hayden scuttling down to New Zealand to talk to them about the Libyan threat in the South Pacific and so on.
So, sorry, I just have to understand, why would he want to see someone like Colonel Gaddafi, you know, I'm understating it here, a seriously unpleasant human being.
Yeah.
And much hated by his own people, as we saw.
Well, he wasn't the finish. He was loved at the time we was going there. He was rebuilding Libya, really. But Michael Mansell went with a group of white Australians who were going as well. Now, they did have an organisation called the Mathaba. The Mathaba is an anti-imperialist world organisation of which Gaddafi was patron. And so they used to hold their conferences in Tripoli. An Aboriginal woman from West Australia was supposed to go. Her daughter became ill, so she gets in touch with Michael and he says, yeah, I'll go. So away he goes. As I say, the world turned topsy-turvy here. And the next year, he plans to take a group. So I got in touch with him and said, what if I get an all-Aboriginal film group and come over and film what you're doing as this group? And he said, yeah, that'd be good. So I got a deal with David Hill that we could do that. He agreed. Then David Hill went down to Canberra for a weekend or something, and he spoke with Bob Hawke and Clyde Holding, the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs then. And the next thing I know, there's a press release out blaming Mansell by saying, Michael Mansell's not going to dictate to ABC that we have to take an all-Aboriginal film crew to Libya. In fact, we're not setting any film crews there at all. So I rang up Channel 10 and borrowed a camera off one of the reporters, got 10 days leave without pay. He met me at the airport and gave me a crash course on how to use it. That's how good I was with him. And I filmed 8.5 hours of our activities in Libya.
Do you think there was some naivety? I mean, Gaddafi was actually supported by Soviet imperialism, you know.
He
called himself an anti-imperialist. What do you think about all that now, in the benefit of hindsight, Jim?
In Michael Mansell's own words, we didn't know any Libyans that had massacred Aborigines. As far as we're concerned, we were living under the threat of the terrorist colonial nation that tries to convince everybody that there's such a thing as post-colonialism.
Did you go to Libya in the end?
Yeah.
And did you meet Gaddafi when you were there?
No, he was busy away talking to the Egyptians about the threat from Israel.
So what did you do once you got there?
We were in a camp that they have where they hold these Mathaba conferences, and they house everybody. And so they had held a number of discussions with us, with the Mathaba heads, trying to find out what we was up to and whether we were going to become militant. And we sort of said, no, we're not going to become militant. Just give us some money because we want to go back and train more political activists. We have a peaceful struggle.
You've decided in more recent years to move away from politics. Why have you chosen to do that, Jim?
Horses for courses, really. Michael Mansell's the political leader, and his role is to carry those politics, and he's good at it. I'm not. It's not my thing, really. I see myself as a cultural advocate, a cultural artist. I'm the only older male that I know in Tasmanian Aboriginal community that undertakes ceremony, like healing ceremonies and things like that, for different things like the Brighton Bypass, when we were being kicked out of there to protesting against the bulldozers being in there. There's 42,000 years of heritage so far that we've found. And it's taken me a long time to get to that point to stop thinking that I am a political figure and focus more on the kinds of things that I should be doing in the Aboriginal community that will generate an ongoing, and I feel, critical part of maintaining our knowledge, culture and ceremonies.
There's been an ongoing debate in the last 10-15 years or so amongst Aboriginal leaders about the role of welfare with Aboriginal people, with some people saying it's necessary and to get something started to begin with, and there's people like Noel Pearson who say it's like toxic for Aboriginal people. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I do. It's a bit hard to just sort of say, oh, well, let's take away the welfare support. But I think what's happening wrongly is that we're being meted out bits and pieces of money to run programs that are designed by non-Aboriginal people. I think the money's got to come to us as a bulk thing, and I think they've got to be able to trust us to that they can invest in us to solve our own problems and acknowledge that we do have a right of self-determination, and under our self-determination we can make these things work better. I do think that we need to work a little bit in a partnership. We've seen lots of dishonesty around Aboriginal organisations with monies coming, grant monies and that coming from governments. And I think that accountability is still, nevertheless, should be maintained. But I think that we've got to be given some freedom and trust under self-determination to find our own way.
Do you think over time, non-Aboriginal Australia is getting better at seeing Australia in an Aboriginal way?
No, I think it's going backwards. I think that we're finding there's more of an endemic racial hatred specifically aimed at Aborigines in this country. And I think that this is something that has been fostered by the governments and by the public media. And I really do think that until they can rein themselves in, they will not get rid of the racist outlook on Aboriginal people across the country. This is a really serious thing that isn't our problem. In fact, it really is non-Aboriginal Australia's problem and should be looked on and dealt with according to the idea of Australia, the country of a fair go. I think they've got to really go back and have a look at themselves in Australia and sort out the problems that they've got and how they might overcome those that are producing the problems with Aboriginal people.
What I really meant by that question was in terms of looking at the land itself. I mean, I remember the opening ceremony of the Sydney 2000 Olympics. You know, we had a lot of fun. We had stockmen at the start and people with crazy lawnmowers and what have you.
Yeah.
But when we want to get widescreen, when we want to get really big and cosmic in talking about Australia, we instinctively now as a country reach for Aboriginal motifs, Aboriginal ways of thinking and ways of seeing the land. I don't know. What, do you see that?
Oh, it's sort of like smoke and mirrors, I think. You know, it's all right to sort of pump these things up in front while all these other things are unresolved. And I think that the things that are not being resolved outweigh the ideas that, oh, look, we're trying to be a good country with Aborigines, but nevertheless turn a blind eye at the things that are really not good. Forcing Aboriginal people off their remote communities is because of the cost, for instance. The wealth that Australia's made out of these Aboriginal lands should be enough for them to realise that they should assist these people by, as I say, go back to that self-determination, give them enough money to be able to develop a lifestyle that's not going to have them sitting there like welfare dependents and therefore all sorts of problems arising, drugs, alcohol, boredom, family and domestic violence, nowhere with all to be able to manage their lands. All these things, I think, are quite unfair that Australia can be a wealthy country and yet they feel that Aboriginal people have to be meted out a welfare existence.
Jim, you've been writing poetry for a very long time. How's that changed over the years?
Oh, well, you know, I suppose I don't write as much political poetry as I used to, but I still do. I write a lot of poetry that sort of talks about country. I do some collaboration work sometimes with non-Aboriginal people in writing.
Where's your home base now?
Cape Barron Island.
Where you started?
Where I sort of started.
Come full circle in a way, I suppose.
It's a nice, quiet place to be.
Yeah, what's your life like there? Where do you live? What's your
daily routine like? Yeah, I've got a house. I live by myself. I've got a son that lives there. My older son lives over in the island as well. He's got his own place, though. I have visitors now and then, but mainly it gives me a chance to have some solitude and to be able to write if I want to write. Sometimes I develop a project with the community there. Like we had a theatre project there the year before last, I produce a newsletter for the island every quarter called the Truwana Telegraph. Truwana, by the way, is the name, the Aboriginal name for Cape Barron Island. I don't do as much work there as I probably could do, but with only 65 people living on the island, it's a bit difficult to have everybody interested in doing these kinds of arts things that I'm interested in.
Yeah, if you're doing one arts project, that's everyone on the island, I suppose, just about.
That'll change, I think. I've got a piece of land there that I call Krakeneka, and I'm developing a school, an Aboriginal school of philosophy, and it'll be launched next March, in 2017, and we'll light the sacred fire, and from there on in I'll be holding summer schools.
Do you still go fishing?
Still go fishing.
How political are you now?
I haven't changed. I just don't try and be the political figure or leader of things. I think that it's more important for me to write, develop theatre, whatever it is that I'm dealing with.
Do you stand back and look at the course of your life, which is really amazing? I mean, all these different jobs you've done all your life and these different places you've been and look where you are now, and reflect on that?
Yeah, I do. I sometimes think to myself, did you really do all that, Jim? It's sort of like sometimes you can sort of look back and say, by gee, you was naive there, wasn't you? By God, look at those bloody stupid things you was doing then, and so on.
But if you like that, if you weren't like that, you'd never go and see anything, would you?
Probably not.
No.
But the most important thing that I look back on my life and say to myself, Jim, you've had one hell of an adventure.
You're going to write a policy paper on press ganging drunks onto shark boats?
Yeah, maybe just a poem will do.
Fascinating to speak with you, Jim, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.